This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum. Today's topic is discussing the FERC Rule 2222 and some of the newer energy policies that are going on and result of the last administration. And Baird Brown is going to be speaking about that, followed up by a couple other people. And Baird, with ECO and Law, why don't you go ahead and start?
Thanks, Sierra. I'm going to start with Order 2222. It sounds like some occult numerology, but the FERC has always liked things like that, Order 888 and so forth. FERC started 3 years ago, roughly, a rulemaking in which they were talking about storage and aggregation. And many of us submitted comments way back when, particularly about the aggregation rules, and they ended up splitting their docket apart and bringing out their storage rule, which was promptly challenged in the courts, and they finally got their storage rule unscathed through the courts. And then shortly after that, and only about 2 months ago now, they came out with Order 2222, and which deals with the issues of aggregation. And it'll become obvious what that means in a minute if it's not already. Aggregation basically is that you can take lots of distributed energy resources, renewable or otherwise, storage or otherwise, and put them all together and use them to sell power into wholesale markets. And the people that somebody's clicking papers, and if everybody can mute themselves, it would be much easier.
Okay, so let's just have everybody unmute your own lines.
Star 4, right?
4-star, actually.
The 4-star, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And Carly just joined.
Okay, yep. Go ahead, mute your own lines. And Bear's talking.
Okay. So, they finally came out, and we were down to three commissioners, and miraculously, then Chair Chatterjee had sort of softened his attitude toward renewable and distributed energy over time as he's been at FERC, and he joined with Commissioner Glick, the one Democrat that was then on the commission, to put this in over the objections of the one other Republican commissioner at the time, who then Trump assigned as chairman to get back at Glick, to get back at Chatterjee. But of course he's gone now too, and Glick is the chair, so life is good. So what they brought forth was kind of everything we hoped for 2 years ago when we were all filing and asking them to do it. First of all, every regional transmission organization and independent system operator like CAISO or PJM, who is required to amend their tariffs, and their tariffs are basically, among other things, what defines the markets that they run for wholesale services, whether energy or ancillary services. And they're required to amend their tariffs to permit participation in the RTO markets by aggregators of DERs. And that includes basically any technology, any kind of generation, local generation, storage, demand response. And an aggregation can include all three. And the different capabilities of the different resources in the aggregation can complement each other. So they don't all have to be doing the same thing at the same time. And they'll get a standard market agreement that for everybody, so it's sort of plug and play. FERC didn't require new interconnection rules, which mostly are the creature of the individual utilities with some FERC supervision and jurisdiction for folks that will be exporting to the FERC, FERC-regulated RTOs. But while they won't assert jurisdiction now, they're going to be sort of watching to make sure there weren't any abuses to use interconnection to inhibit access to the RTO markets. An aggregator can use any applicable participation model. And by participation model, FERC means, they've got one for intermittent resources like solar and wind, and one for regular fuel-fired generation, and another one for batteries because, they're time-limited in the amount of charge and discharge they can do. So there are different models that exist in some of the RTOs, but an aggregator can sign up, so long as it can meet the requirements of the model, it can sign up for any of them. So it can include batteries in its model, but it doesn't have to use the battery model if it otherwise can, play collectively in ways that meet the requirements of another model. Still getting an awful lot of noise. Did somebody mute themselves?
I know. I'm going to try muting everybody, and hopefully we can get you unmuted here, Baird, because it is a lot of noise. It's a little scary, though. All right, let's see if I can unmute you. Baird, can you say something to see if we can got you here? I don't know what's going on. Okay. Maybe I'm not patient enough. There we go. Okay,
Barry,
okay,
I think you've got me now, yes.
Yeah, okay, perfect.
All right.
Go ahead.
So the RTOs can use rules to prevent double counting. In other words, there's a concern that you not be paid twice in two different markets, like to your local utility in the RTO for the same export of power. But that doesn't mean that you can't, for instance, sell reserves into the RTO market. And then when you get called to provide reserves, you're separately selling power in response to that call. And so that's not double counting. So there's what they basically said is you can have those rules to make sure there isn't double counting, but try and make sure that they're narrow and flexible so that they don't prevent access to multiple markets. It says an aggregation can be as small as 100 kilowatts. There's no maximum required, and hopefully the RTOs won't try to impose them. And a single qualifying resource can individually use an aggregator participation rule. You can be aggregated, but you can be an aggregation of one, in effect. And of particular interest to me, anyway, in that is that by extension, I think a single microgrid, which may have, say, solar and a battery and a cogeneration facility all in the same microgrid, can aggregate all those things and, make a single application as an aggregator, which would be fabulous. There are some rules regarding what happens if you have an aggregation that covers multiple nodes on the wholesale system that are complicated, and I didn't follow them very closely. And there are flexible requirements for bidding parameters that are pretty good. And you don't really have to give a whole lot of information about the resources in the aggregation so long as you tell them what the aggregation as a whole can do. You don't have to have the same necessarily metering and telemetry requirements that you do to participate directly as a utility scale generator, so long as they quote unquote serve the purpose. So hopefully, you know, it's going to be as simple and easy as possible. And finally, they encourage the RTOs to set up frameworks for collaboration with the distribution utilities. And you're required to submit your aggregation to review by the distribution utility to make sure you're not causing a problem on the distribution system, but there's a limited time for review, so hopefully that's not going to be a cause of a great deal of delay. So in short, this is sort of everything those of us who were filing and participating at the time hoped for, and the you know, it should really open up the market wherever there are RTOs and ISOs to participate, for DER of all sorts to participate in larger or smaller aggregations. And I think the real interesting question, and we can get to that more in the discussion, is what will the distribution utilities do in response, and will they start to, you know, open up markets and meet, you know, rather than just sort of sit by and watch this happen, will they try and move to a more distributed resource friendly model for themselves so that they don't get completely cut out of the picture? But we shall see. The second thing I'm going to talk briefly about is the Energy Act of 2020. That is about 600 pages worth, called Division Z of the Consolidated Appropriations Act, which you probably know of as the stimulus bill. And what you probably heard is that it's $600 per family, and tax credits got extended for renewable energy for another 2 years before they, solar in particular, before they start to trail down. But that's actually not even in the Energy Act of 2020. That's in Division EE, Taxpayer Certainty and Disaster Relief Act of 2020. And the Energy Act covers a whole range of things. It's really the most comprehensive energy legislation that's come out since 2005. So there are a whole bunch of provisions which I won't try to even touch on, but the ones I will try and touch on some are the energy efficiency and renewable energy ones. The in the energy efficiency, they have expanded energy performance contracting for federal facilities. That's everything from military bases to post offices to you name it, to include water savings as well as energy savings. And they made a huge, what to my way of thinking is a huge revision, which is that the agency can keep any revenues it gets from grants or energy sales or REC sales or other environmental attributes to use it to fund its energy performance contract. So before, if you entered into a contract with a utility and they were ready to pay you for exports of energy, you just had to send that back to Treasury with a note saying, you're welcome. And now you get to keep it for the facility that's actually doing the energy performance contract. So I think that's really a huge innovation. There are, I won't even try and stop on all the titles, but the, or subdivisions, but there's a product rebate program that basically means there's going to be a credit of $25 per horsepower for variable speed motors that are included in equipment, such as air conditioners and things like that. So there's a, you know, the costs of energy retrofits will go down by the amount of the rebates that are, will now be offered with these large pieces of equipment. There is a section on smart building acceleration, which is going to basically be conducting an evaluation of samples of privately owned, not governmental, smart buildings that demonstrate a systems approach to integrating operations for generation, consumption, and storage, e.g. a building acting as a microgrid, and how they can act as dynamic resources for the grid. So that's mostly in the study, but it shows where their thinking is going. There's a whole section on ceiling fans if you're a fan, and you can look that up at section 1008 if you want. 1010 is another sort of study section on the nexus of energy and water for sustainability. And they're meant to have an intergovernmental, interagency coordination on the one hand, the water needed to produce fuels and electricity, and I assume that includes the irrigation water for corn ethanol as well as just the cooling tower water for power plants. And on the other hand, the energy needed for water and wastewater management. And so they're thinking they're meant to be breaking down the federal silos. One of the things that I'm most interested in is Section 1011. For those who are familiar with the Weatherization Assistance Program, which helps low-income families with all kinds of energy efficiency home improvements to building shell and so forth and heaters and things like that. And it's been reauthorized and funded for 4 years going out. And the big thing it does, a couple of big things, it adds renewable energy and other advanced technology as weatherization materials, quote unquote, you know, as defined, so that you can not only go in and put insulation in the roof, you can go in and put solar on the roof, and it's all part of the federally funded program. It also expands the use of private contractors and allows you to take into account the health benefits of indoor air quality. And that's also huge. What's often going on is you've got leaks in the roof and they're causing mold, and mold is causing health problems. And now you can start sort of thinking about that as an integral part of what you're doing. There's also an interesting grant program that's coming up that's going to be about $25 million a year for grants that can last up, be up to $2 million and last up to 3 years. And what they really want to do is pilot all-in whole home retrofits as sort of a add-on or an integration with the WAP program. So you can do pre-weatherization, which means you can go in and fix that leaky roof. You can do the healthy indoor air. You can do the renewable energy. You can do home management systems. You know, you make the home smart. You can hire and train from within the disadvantaged community. You're meant to be building contractor capacity and collecting data and doing training. So they're I think signaling again the direction that WAP is going, and I think that's a great direction. And this was, you know, snuck through in the waning days of the Trump administration. So you can only imagine what the Biden administration will want to do by way of further advances. And there's a section on benchmarking for federal agencies on energy and water resilience that's going to go on throughout the federal government. There's a section on combined heat and power technical assistance. So there's a whole range of stuff going on in the energy efficiency section. The stuff that's in the renewable energy section is mostly in the area of studies and grants. They didn't really break any new ground in terms of programs on the ground. There is a bunch of focus and funding for grid integration R&D, which again means buildings and local DER and making the grid smarter. And there is a bunch of funding for microgrids for isolated communities and for critical infrastructure that are cost-shared demonstration projects that are going to be, there's going to be available about $175 to $200 million per year available to local governments, basically. So watch for a grant program coming near you. There's way more that's in there, but it's worth going and pulling up the bill, which isn't hard to find, and just sort of poking around the table of contents and seeing if there's anything that is particularly up your alley. And with that, I'll open it to discussion.
All right. I see Charlie Holland is here. Charlie, do you have anything to add to that? Do a 4-star and see if it unmutes your line. Do you want to try that and see what happens? If not, I will mute it from here.
Am I
okay,
on?
Good. Yeah, good.
Good.
It works.
Good. So I'm just so glad that I'm following Baird on this, as in all things. So what I'm going to add is a little bit on 222, a little bit of tiny insight, and then sort of an update on the thing that I follow a lot, which is renewables on brownfields. So I just want to highlight a couple things that Baird said and maybe expand upon them. And this may well be obvious to folks, but let me say it. So, you know, the FERC Order 222 is just sort of the opening shot. I'm going to go slowly also. This is the last thing I'll say to Baird. Baird, interrupt me or disagree if I say anything you disagree with. So 222 is sort of the opening shot. There are a number of different sort of petitions for reconsideration of particular pieces of it. That's A. B, depending on what comes of them, there will then be litigation, the way there was over 841 and for batteries. Two, recognize that what FERC Order 222 does is call for FERC jurisdictional ISOs to then develop their own plans. And I think the nominal deadline, I think, was July 2021. That's when the compliance filing is due. And a company that I'm general counsel for and that I follow called Customized Energy Solutions, here comes shameless plug, part of what it does is to follow closely for clients, you know, what is happening in those individual ISOs. And I won't go into detail on this. I've got a chart up in front of me, but I think it's fair to say, and tell me if you agree or disagree, anyone, but for those ISOs that already were comfortable with had already developed and had sort of robust, demand response participation in the wholesale markets, are already sort of comfortable with bringing in these sort of consumer and smaller resource-based resources into the wholesale market, they're sort of ready for this. But some ISOs, and I'm looking at this and I may have this wrong, but perhaps MISO and perhaps SPPP, I think they either have or likely will ask for extensions of time by which they have to get their plans in place because they're you know, it's a little bit newer for them. Let me pause there. Baird or anyone else, would you expand or contradict that piece of the process that we're involved with?
No, I think that's exactly right. I think that on the one hand, Cal ISO actually adopted the model for this 2 years ago, which FERC referenced when they adopted 2222. But in fact, they have a narrow model that they're now going to have to really widen out. They've only been doing really demand response. And the underlying state of California rules don't make it easy, so California is going to have to play catch up. On the other hand, I think ISO New England is way ahead of the game, probably further ahead than anybody. That used to belong to PJM, but they've kind of been overtaken by ISO New England, I would say.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense with what I'm looking at. Let's see, what else? To sort of state what probably is the obvious, all this does is sort of create a legal pathway that maybe hadn't been there before. My sense is of course it's true that whether or not it makes economic sense, or more precisely, whether or not a facility or aggregation wouldn't do better under a state-specific incentive program or some other sort of already existing program that may be more economically attractive, the actual practical impact of this obviously will first turn on what individual ISO rules look like. And even then, depending on the state that you're in, it may not give you any more economic opportunity than already exists under some existing program. Let me pause there and look for any reactions from Baird or anyone else.
I'm going to open this up to anybody else who would like to comment. And
great.
So
great.
I'll unmute everybody. If anybody wants to comment on this, please do a 4 and a star and unmute your phone, and I can tell that, and I'll call on you. So hopefully this works out the way it's supposed to. So.
Oh, this is Larissa. I got a question. Already hearing opposition, at the state level, and I'm seeing maneuvering already to kind of block the tier bypassing. And, I mean, this would allow, direct participation from below to the wholesale markets. But I'm already witnessing maneuvering and an intent to try to really channel things all through the distribution utilities and turn them into super aggregators. What's your reaction on that?
Yeah, at least from the clients we work with, that is exactly the fear. I'm not aware of folks actually seeing that yet. Doesn't surprise me.
Oh, yeah. Look at the PEPCO and Exelon. They've been mobilizing for a long time. Their programs, because within this, Baird said, of course, FERC's going to watch to see, nature of abuses, what goes on at the state level. But, I'm already involved in a lot of these regulatory venues where, the programs are being set up in a way where it is the utility that's really going to be the actor and participant in the wholesale market. To really try to block to the extent possible the tier bypassing. And in fact, this is being aggravated by certain labs and like Jeff Taft. Jeff Taft is coming out to say that it's actually technically infeasible to have this tier bypassing. I really, he's an engineer, but this was aired to some extent during the, Dura aggregation proceeding, and there were a lot of others that contested his position. But that's what I'm witnessing that's moving along.
Well, I guess the two things. I mean, it's been going on all along. the Princeton University microgrid has been selling frequency response to PJM for 5 or 8 or 10 years. I can't remember how long now. So what's wrong with this picture? But having said that, in a perfect world, if you could take off your cynical hat for a moment and imagine distribution utilities that actually served as real dispassionate market makers within their distribution system, so that they actually accounted for the difference in value between some place where there's congestion on their distribution system and the places where there's not. They would make an appropriate intermediary. The trouble, as we all know, is that if we can find one that's, where's Demosthenes? Where with a lantern? I mean, can we find an honest utility?
The thing that bothers me is that I think this provides an enabling framework, and I personally really feel that if it's allowed evolve, I think functions will become differentiated and sorted out by the market between the wholesale and the distribution levels in a way that, like you said, the utility will have appropriate areas in which to function and thrive. But I am already witnessing this kind of maneuvering, and I believe there is going to be opposition in the works contesting this tier bypassing.
Okay, I would like to open this up to anybody else who would like to contribute to the conversation. So if you do a 4 and a star, and, I guess you don't have to. It looks like your lines are unmuted. And go ahead and dive in.
Yeah, this is Bob Perry. Just to follow on the conversation, I'm not thoroughly versed in all of this, and I appreciate the opportunity that FERC 222 opens up to discuss differences and between the functions of, the wholesale and distribution markets. To me, distributed energy resources, I focus on the distributed part of it and the locational benefit of it being within the distribution system and the resiliency that confers using that resource within the distribution system. And it just seems that if you open the door for a distributed resource to commit itself out into the wholesale market, and then you get a disruptive event that, makes the immediate need of that resource in the location it's at, how does that get sorted out? Because it seems to me that distributed energy resources have an obligation to serve the community, the need in which it's located. So, I can see why people are concerned about these resources, putting themselves out into the larger market when they may be needed at home. So,
but anybody else have anything to comment to somebody who has not been heard yet? Do a 4 and a star and unmute your phone. Okay, go ahead.
So this is Charlie, and I'll just throw this in. I just want to, I think, highlight something else, which is, the potential here, to state the obvious, is to increase the source, the capital stack, the value stack for any particular project. Doesn't guarantee that, but it gives the potential for that. So, what's really called for individual projects, whether it's microgrids, aggregators, will this, under my particular ISO's version of the implementation plan, will this give me new sources of revenue streams that will do me better than the new program that my state put in and of itself? So, location. That's all I got. And the other thing I'll say is there's some examples where this is that should now be expanded upon. The Con Ed Brooklyn Queens project, Green Mountain Power teamed up with Tesla for some distributed storage. You know, there's a number of sort of one-offs that are out there now, or several one-offs that now should be able to be multiplied as sort of the business models to be copied. I'm done for now.
Anybody else here?
Well, this is Baird. I wanted to respond a little bit to Bob. Because my focus is exactly what his is. It's the local resiliency from things like microgrids. but there, it's not even that you just need utility markets, but you need distribution utility infrastructure that allows local resources to be used locally in an emergency. So they've got to sectionalize the grid, and they've got to have, what are called distributed resource control systems that are that can manage locally and are semi-autonomous. It's not the central control room anymore, and they're balancing sections of their grid that are being supported by local resources. So they not only have to conceive of the idea that they could buy services from the local resources and give them access to the grid, but they have to start build the grid that can really effectively make use of them. And, you know, some of us have been trying to bend the ear of utilities and saying, hey, there's a whole new world out here. You know, there's something in it for you. When are you going to get with it? And so far, I'm not seeing much uptake.
I totally agree with you. And yeah.
I'd like to get back to any regulations or policy changes, if anybody else has anything else to contribute on that topic, and otherwise we can continue in this direction.
Well, I think you'd ask me when we talked, this is Charlie, Sarah, to talk about anything new that's happening with respect to encouraging energy infrastructure on environmentally impaired or contaminated land. Either now or later, I can talk briefly about that.
Yeah, that's going to be a topic we're going to handle on the next call, actually. I'll get into that in a minute.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to make sure we were finished with this topic on policy, if anybody else has anything else to add on that. No? All right, go ahead with your discussion then.
Okay, it's just to sort of highlight in general the topic and to give one example. So again, the issue is many states and the federal government. So the federal government in the 2018 Build Act, which in part deals with grants for folks who are investigating and potentially cleaning up brownfields. Brownfields are generally something that is less horrible than a Superfund site. So in the Federal Build Act and in a number of states, sort of individual programs and laws, there is an increasing sort of encouragement of, as between a greenfield and a brownfield, let's put that solar farm, that project on a brownfield. So just as an example, last year, New York, as part of their clean energy standard, they issued a request for inquiry or for information looking for large-scale renewable energy development sites with a focus on brownfields. So, and they actually sort of describe it or define that fairly broadly as previously developed or disturbed sites. They're looking to protect, i.e. not use, not site things in environmental justice areas, in high-quality and agricultural sites, but looking, apart from those sort of don't go there, looking to use brownfields and sort of giving a preference for that. So I think I mentioned in a past call, some states' RPSs actually give rec tickers for sites that are on brownfields. So, for example, I think Delaware still has a program whereby you can get 3 RECs for every megawatt hour of electricity if your facility is on a environmentally impaired or defined brownfield. So again, the big picture point is there may well be drivers and incentives baked into whatever programs you're working under to put a site under on a brownfield or environmentally impaired site. And that's all before you get to the sort of softer issue that often communities are going to be more open to a facility going on the old landfill, going on the old RCRA site, as opposed to occupying Farmer Brown's farm field. And I'll stop there.
All right. Any comments on that or anybody else? Any local policy changes that might be of interest to people? All right. Anybody? Baird?
Hi, how are you? Yeah, I'm doing fine. My name is Norman Lithicutter. We have a couple of accounts here. Could I have 2 register votes, please?
Yep. Somebody needs to mute their phone. Norm, I think it's you. All right. Anybody else here? Craig?
What?
Do you have any comments?
Can you hear
about
me?
This?
What?
Craig
Lewis?
Craig Lewis.
Oh, Craig Lewis.
Yeah.
Not Rick Ding.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you, yeah. We're good.
Well, as an unusual situation, I don't have a lot to add. I think that Baird and Mr. Perry and others, I think their comments resonated with my thoughts. And I've been multitasking, so my apologies. If I did chime in too deeply, I might be off course. So I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Anybody else have anything to add to this?
Baird, I have a question.
No, go ahead, please. Introduce yourself, please.
This is David Dupereau. I have a question. It may
sure.
be, and that is, who's doing aggregation of distributed resources across the country? I mean, they talk about, I'm new to this. I'm fairly new to this concept, and I'm just wondering who's doing it, or if people aren't doing it, who might do it, and how?
Well, this is Baird. There are a lot of people who are doing it. There were especially, and I'm going to go blank on their names, but starting 5 years or so ago, there was a whole industry that grew up to do aggregation. I think some of them got very big. Some of them fell by the wayside. You know, people thought they could do it in a garage with their computer. And to some extent they could until things went wrong. I can say from personal experience that not all of them were really set up to effectively enforce, they were just sort of running around to anybody with a backup diesel generator and kind of signing them up. So some of them were not really enforcing the demand response when called, I know from personal experience. But on the other hand, there's a class of folks and, there's a company that I'm very familiar with called Icetech, who has developed the software that a lot of the big sophisticated campus microgrids use. That's, Harvard, MIT, Princeton, but big pharmaceutical companies and, campuses as well. And they act as an aggregator for their clients, and they've developed not only the kind of internal dashboard for the microgrid, but also the you know, the weather prediction and grid modeling so that they really know what to expect in the wholesale markets when they take their clients into them. So it's, you know, there's a, and you know, I guess, well, I don't know where it's come to, but I, even Comcast was thinking about this a little while ago. And, you know, anybody who's got a wire into your house, in effect, could try and do it. So Alexa probably can, you know, manage your wholesale sales as well, you know, coming to a home near you. And there's a lot of interest in the contributions that individual building appliances controls can make, and a lot of some research that suggests that that's actually got a lot of value. So I think we've only begun to scratch the surface, and there will be some big players. I suspect some of the big ESCOs will be playing, you know, people like Johnson Controls and Siemens. And that's speculation on my part, not because I know, but.
So, anybody else here?
This is Charlie. Let me just add, repeat something that Baird said that I found. So I'm going back now to 222. That struck me as interesting and important, which is that the order explicitly recognizes the ability for an aggregation to include both in front of the meter and behind the meter resources. So the scale that a before, you know, in front of the meter, you know, let's say single facility can offer, combined with sort of the breadth and heterogeneity of what might be behind the meter, can all be, you know, is all supposed to be allowed to come in as a single participant. And I'm not aware, I mean, it's, that had been an area of, I think, some significant regulatory uncertainty that now this removes. And I think, you know, my prediction is that there's going to be, you know, some additional people. I mean, the question is, who does this aggregation? Well, now there may well be more people because they've got more ingredients to put into their aggregation. I'm done.
Okay. Any other response to that? Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Bob Perry again. I just think when you're talking about aggregating distributed resources, there has to be a number of gatekeepers. And the first one is your distribution system operator. I think if you're a distributed energy resource within that distribution system and you want to bid out into the larger market, you have to, you know, get their blessing before that energy or the rights or obligations to that energy gets moved outside of that area. And so, to me, the obvious entity to aggregate within that system is the distribution system operator. Yeah, they're subject, they could subject to corruption, but, you know, that's true with all power. But, you know, for me, the primary objective of having distributed energy resources is to increase system resiliency. So, you know, I can see why people are concerned, and that there has to be some kind of hierarchy of oversight and control before, you know, distributed resources are aggregated and then bid out into the larger market.
I guess one thing I'd say is that there's, you know, as little excuse as there was for making utilities monopolies in the first place, when you've got a wholesale market that's a functioning market, there's little or no excuse for making a monopoly over who can access or how you can access the wholesale market. So I don't see FERC knuckling under to that very quickly. And so if the utilities are going to fight, as Larissa says, God bless them. I think they're on the losing end of that stick.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left, and I would like to discuss a little bit about the next call. Unless
Could
there
I
other
just
comments
add
on
one
it.
Thing, Sierra?
No, absolutely. Go ahead, Larissa.
This real quick, Bob, I thought I had unmuted myself and I was talking, but now you're answering. So, you know, first, Bob, there has already been a lot of, you know, DERP aggregator participation in certain markets, like Baird said, PGM has been a leader, CalISO, and a lot of this has been in the demand response. And there have just been huge benefits from it. I mean, PJM has been touting this from the beginning, the beneficial effects, and it has not been, you know, undercutting or compromising at the distribution level. Certainly as this expands, there'll be a need for protocols, but like they had a technical conference during this their aggregation proceeding, and a lot of the regions, and particularly CalISO, came out to indicate the kind of protocols that are being established to coordinate the wholesale and the distribution level so that you'd have certain priorities set so that if there is, you know, a certain critical need, you know, disaster hits, disruptions, there's an understanding ahead of time on how to deal with that. And California described the kind of protocols that it has developed, and I think you know, and opening the door for these coordination frameworks, I think that's one purpose of them, to get this kind of coordination and harmonization and, you know, when should the wholesale yield to the distribution level and kind of make it clearer, the roadmaps and the prioritization, certain priorities and who will get a say when. And I think that will be evolved through these coordination frameworks.
I want to just, this is Craig Lewis. I do have one thing to say based on Bob's and Reese's comments there, and that is that there's a real example that the Clean Coalition has encountered, and that is where frequency balancing, which is managed at the transmission level, right, because it's a broad area. The entire grid basically can do frequency balancing. And so if the ISO RTO has a call to help support frequency regulation, that is going to either get resources on the grid really fast or off the grid really fast, right? Generation capacity is going to be on or off. That's how you balance frequency. The issue that Bob is rightly bringing up is that voltage balancing happens at the local level because voltage is balanced through VARs, reactive power, and reactive power doesn't travel very far. So you actually have to do it locally if you want to do it well and efficiently. So if you're down on a feeder and you have a voltage balancing issue, the DSO should make a call to either get energy on or off the grid, really, you know, VARs on or off the grid. That means energy on or off the grid, which could be in counteracting a transmission call for frequency balancing. The problem is that there are no markets anywhere in the country that I'm aware of for voltage balancing. There are markets for frequency balancing, so you can have that, have a call for that. It could be completely counterproductive to a voltage balancing issue that a DSO is just managing as part of their general operation. So there are real issues here. I trust Larissa's comment that, you know, there's things in process to try to get these things coordinated, but one of the first ways we need to coordinate it is establish a voltage balancing construct.
I definitely agree with that. And that's, to me, also in this differentiation of the services where, you know, what is really more appropriate, the wholesale, what will be developed at the retail. But California actually has become a real good model, as I said, in these technical conference. They did go over the kind of protocols that are evolving you know, really have these courtesies, have these understanding and coordination in terms of the timing and different priorities. And based upon what was aired, I think this is very feasible.
Okay. All right. So we got off topic a little bit, but also very interesting. And that topic will be handled in another future conference call because it looks like it's a good one for a discussion all by itself. On Thursday, we're going to have a call that's a little bit different than normal, and I think it's one of the most important calls that we've had as far as cities are concerned. What I want to do is go through a series of technologies that cities who are under ISOs might conceivably be able to implement. So what are the limitations and what are the possibilities? I sent out in the email a list of different technologies, basically, and if anybody has anything to add to that, please let me know and I'll put it on the list for Thursday, but I'd like to go through them, and this is for future webinars where we're taking a whole sequence of events as far as the process is concerned, starting out from the very beginning with cities and people who are wanting to convince cities to move forward on renewable energy. Where do you start? And we have some experts in that field, and then we have people who are experts in a lot of technical fields, but if you're talking to a city, what are the things they can actually do? I mean, how can they get underneath the controls of the ISO? So, and in some states, I'm sure it's quite different than it is in other states, but let's have a discussion about that and narrowly on that, because it will take at least an hour, maybe even longer, to get through some of these technologies. Might even be two calls. But I want to sort out what is feasible. So that's the Thursday call, and thanks, everybody, for coming. Baird, that was, as usual, an outstanding presentation and extremely thorough, as expected. And thanks for the contributions for everybody else, and thanks for everybody for coming. So I hope to see everybody on Thursday with all kinds of ideas.
Thanks, Sierra.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.